Thank you everyone for joining us here at the Kelty Mental Health Resource Center for today's pinwheel education session on building a healthy relationship with video games. And the pinwheel education series is a bi-monthly forum that brings together experts and the public to talk about mental health and mental wellness. Everything related to the pinwheel series, including a recording of today's session, can be found at keltymentalhealth.ca/pinwheel. Also, we appreciate your feedback. So if you can, please fill out your feedback form that you have on the table. Or if you registered for the event online, you will receive an email after today's event with a link to a feedback survey. Please fill it out, as this helps us plan and improve the pinwheel series for everyone. So that would be a big help. For those of you joining us for the first time, the Kelty Mental Health Resource Center is a provincial mental health and substance use information and resource center serving BC children, youth, and families. We also offer peer support to families and youth, as well as to people of all ages struggling with eating disorders. Please go to our website, keltymentalhealth.ca, for more information, resources, and for our contact information. One content note before we get started is, unfortunately, our youth speaker with lived experience is unable to join us today because they are sick. And so we're really sorry that Darius can't be with us today, but he has agreed to come in and let me interview him about his experience at a later date when he's feeling better. And so I'll make sure that will be recorded and posted to the website as well. And I'll send out an update about that when that happens. So keep an eye out for that. Start by introducing our first speaker. It is my pleasure to welcome Dr. Tyler Black back to the Pinwheel series. Dr. Tyler Black completed his Bachelor of Science with honors in pharmacology at the University of Alberta in 1999 and completed medical school at the same university in 2003. He completed residency training in psychiatry at Dalhousie University and the University of British Columbia in 2008 and completed his child and adolescent psychiatry subspecialty that same year. He works primarily at BC Children's Hospital on the Child and Adolescent Psychiatric Emergency Unit, where he is currently the clinical head. He is also a clinical instructor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of British Columbia. Dr. Black's primary research and clinical interests include emergency psychiatry, suicidology, violence in video games, and cross-cultural psychiatry. Welcome, Dr. Black.
Great, thank you. I'm just putting my phone on vibrate so that it doesn't make any noise. So thanks for having me. So usually whenever I give talks, I usually give a disclosure about my competing interests, and one of my competing interests for this talk is that I am a video gamer. So I play video games regularly, which is very helpful when I'm talking with kids. But also, an area that is of increasing concern for parents, for teachers, for caregivers, and even for some youth is the impact of video games or gaming on their relationships, both with their families, their friends, their performance, and those types of things. I work primarily on an emergency unit. We get about 400 children per year. And there is some percentage, I wouldn't want to hazard a guess as what the percentage is, but there is some percentage for which conflict over video game use is one of the prime reasons why they're in hospital. So it happens. So I get a chance to see this sort of dynamic play out. Usually there's some dynamic of the child finding a video game to be a positive experience and the parents having a negative view of video games. And control over the video games results in some sort of huge thing that results in coming to hospital. So it's the parent-child conflicts where I see most the video game challenges come out. And generally when I look at parent-child conflicts, I look at them as a fight over something that resulted in something. And recently, the over something is video games. But before the area of video games, it was hanging out, or it was being on the phone, or it was watching TV, or it was whatever else it was. There's always fight over something that results in something. And so one of the reasons why I wanted to talk a little bit about developing a healthy relationship with games is because games are neither good nor bad. They're games. Games are best used when recreational. Like everything else recreational, there's not a lot of argument against it if you're having fun doing it and it doesn't hurt you. So games are neutral. They're neither good nor bad. But the problems that we see with games are legitimate. We see some real problems. Whenever a psychiatrist is going in to suss out what's at the root of a problem, we actually look at four buckets of problems. We call it our formulation. It's our fancy way of saying our best way of understanding a patient. And we kind of use a mnemonic called the four P's. The four P's are predisposing factors, precipitating factors, perpetuating factors, and protective factors. And we try and group everything we know about patients into those things. And when we see someone and we look at all of the things that made them their precipitants, all of the things in their history that put them where they are here, the more recent things that have changed, the things that are ongoing, that are giving them difficulties, and the things that could be in place to help them with those problems, we come away with a sense of what our targets are for treatment. Now, fighting over video games gets put in there somewhere. The video game itself gets put either in the precipitating event or a perpetual event. So there's something going on with gaming that's a problem. But I don't want people to exclude all the other things that go into someone presenting with an illness. When someone has an anxiety disorder and they game too much and they don't go to school, it's not about the gaming, it's probably about the anxiety disorder. Or if there's lots of conflict in the home and one of the places the child feels the most safe is when they're online gaming with their friends and they don't want to interact with their family, the gaming could still be very pathological, never going to school, never accomplishing any tasks, not having any other real friends. But still, one of the issues that needs addressing is the conflict that's going on inside the home. So we often over-focus on the target of the fight rather than the background of the fight. So when we look at video games, and I'm looking at someone who's playing too many video games, we call that problem video game playing, which is ironic because it stands for PVP, and PVP is actually a form of gaming. So it's weird that we use that acronym or that initialism for it. But when someone has problem gaming, it's usually best to try and understand why that person has problem gaming rather than let's stop them from gaming. And I gave a Kelty presentation a few months ago on self-injurious behaviors. In the same way, if someone who's self-injuring, all we did was take away their cutting, they would just struggle because self-injury is their way of making themselves feel better. So in the same way, the goal here is not to remove video games, but to create a healthier individual who can enjoy video games but doesn't need them to sort of cope. So usually when I'm told something like my child plays too many video games, my question in my head is, why is that child feeling most successful playing video games? Of all the things that a child could do, why is it that video games are the ones that they're feeling most successful at? In the same way that if I was told my child hangs out with the wrong people, I'd be like, I wonder what it is about those relationships that are so rewarding to that child that they're willing to get in trouble over these friendships. What's going well with that? And so it's important to think about that as well with respect to video games. So video games are varied. They're tremendously varied. There are online shoot 'em up video games like Call of Duty that everybody demonizes. This is a horrible war game, or you're shooting people and all this type of stuff. Call of Duty has a lot of social mechanics. Call of Duty has in it, you can play as a role, someone whose whole job is to support others. Someone whose whole job is to heal other players and help them out when they're in trouble. You can be a very pro-social person in Call of Duty with all this shooting going around. And so when we say Call of Duty is a shooter and kids shouldn't be playing it, so kids shouldn't be playing a game where they can help out other people and they can chat with friends online or those types of things. So games can be a source of social discussion. Right now, a child around age 10 or 12 who went to school and couldn't carry on a conversation about Pokemon Go would be a very disadvantaged child. They would be excluded because that's what all the kids are talking about. They're all playing Pokemon Go, and you don't want to be the one kid that, I don't know what Pokemon Go is. You're going to get excluded because of that group. So they can be actually a source of social discussion. Video game, just in the same way that around the water cooler you might talk about what happened on The Voice last night or something like that. You're either included in that discussion or excluded from it. Video games teach you things. There's never been a game I've played in life that I started with the same skill set I left. Usually the first time I try and play a video game, I'm not very good at it when I start. I either lose the first level or I don't get the full score. By the end of the video game, I'm really good at that game, so it's taught me things. So they actually are, they can be avenues of treatment, and they can be used as well as an escape. So video games, especially now with the more realistic graphics, the more realistic immersion, you can actually go into a video game and come out a few hours later. Simple video games that aren't even that complex, like Candy Crush on the phone for anyone who played it, you can lose time doing that. You literally, you start looking at the phone, then you look up, it's been an hour and a half. So they can be used to avoid things as well. So video games have a number of uses. Why would a young person use video games? The four issues, and this is, I adapted this from a book from Dr. Karashdini called Video Game Play and Addiction, which is actually a really good book. It's quite a balanced look. If a child is struggling with control issues and they play a video game that provides shelter, like you get to build your own world, you get to create your own environment, you get to invite people to participate in your program or whatever it is, that might be a reason why a child who's struggling with control issues generally might find that to be a good alternative. If the child has a low sense of self-esteem or community, and then online they can achieve things and be ranked and get gold star on StarCraft, or you know, get some sort of tier rank on League of Legends, and they can achieve something, but they're struggling with their own self-esteem and outside the video game world, they might be drawn into the video game world. Children who struggle with a sense of identity or lack of direction might find that they can actually develop growth online. They can develop growth in the video game world. Some games are entirely built upon becoming more and more powerful. And certainly children who struggle with mastery of skills will find a whole bunch of skills to master when they're playing video games. So there might be a child who may not do very well with PE, but they are the world's, you know, they are Vancouver's best Counter-Strike player or something like that, and they have a set of skills that allows them to sense mastery, even if it's not. Video game, the more that we study video games, the more we find that some video game playing is actually normal. So there's nothing about video game playing that's abnormal. 98% of children at age 10 play video games. The 2% who don't are not well. There's something going on that they're not playing video games. They're either struggling, they don't have the coordination to do so, or they have some other health issues, or they're really not doing very well. It's developmentally quite normal at this point to be playing video games. So I hope I've laid the stage a little bit for this idea that how should parents see games? They're here, they're not going anywhere, and they are a part of normal child development. Video games are a part of normal development, just like reading is, just like going to school is, just like having friends is. Video games are a part of that normal development. So when I kind of look at how parents should see gaming, I look at games as being good teachers, good attention getters, good distractors, very good time wasters, excellent sleep destroyers, fantastic at destroying sleep, very good at motivating. So there's very few kids who are like, oh, I don't think I want to play this video game anymore. Most kids actually, when they play games, are quite excited to do so. So they're really good at motivation. They're fantastic money makers. There is more money going into the video game industry than 10 movie industries combined. So, you know, there's just a ton of money being made on video games. So it brings up all of the issues with those different things. If games are great teachers, what are you learning? If games are great attention getters, what are you paying attention to? If games are great time wasters, what else could you be doing with your time? The introduction of video games into a child's life brings up one of the most important mechanics in a child's life is every child needs a balanced approach to life. If there is a child out there that's the world's best artist and they're really good at art, but that's all they do, and they don't go to school and they don't have friends and all they do is draw all day, that child is going to run into difficulties. And it would be the same for jogging or potting plants or anything else like that. So what I usually look at when I'm working with parents who are struggling with video games with their kids, I'm usually looking at a mismatch between what the parent is offering in terms of a style of parenting and what the child needs in terms of where they are. So every child starts out in this world being completely dependent. as in they will pass away if you don't feed them. They are completely dependent. They require adults for food. And they go all the way into their teen years where they're actually completely resistant, as in, don't try and feed me, I will not eat your food, right? I'm gonna go get my own stuff. And there's the whole gradation in between. So dependent completely all the way through to defiant, mostly and completely. And that's normal adolescent development. If you're a parent of a child who's at 14 and is struggling with video game challenges, and your approach is, you're not allowed to play video games, there's only two outcomes from that scenario. Number one is the child will play video games and you won't know about it. Or number two is that child is going to fight with you about playing video games. The outcome number three, they're not playing video games, is not happening, right? It's just not gonna happen. So if you're not able to match your parenting approach to where the child is with respect to their autonomy and their need to make their own decisions, you're in for a really bad time. Most children I work with, even the ones who have very entrenched video game behaviors, know that they have other responsibilities. They're smart, they understand things, they know that they're struggling, they know that there may be some difficulties with gaming. But they're not, but what they don't need is, you need to not game. They need to find pathways on how to get back to what it is they need to, they know to do. And it needs to be developed collaboratively. So you need to be able to sit down with a child and say, hey, school's really important to me. How important is it to you right now that you're getting schooling done? If the answer is it's not important to me to get schooling done, you're gonna have a really hard time changing that behavior. Really hard time changing that behavior. If the child says, yeah, school's important to me, I just can't go to school, it's too hard for me to go, then the parent has a job to do, or the person working with the youth has a job to do, make school easier to go to. You can't work with someone who's not motivated to change, and you need to create that motivation. Introduce opportunities, provide diversity, provide other ways for success. And that's where parents and caregivers can give their best effort. Trying to manipulate a 14-year-old's behavior or a 16-year-old's behavior is a lot of effort for a tiny, tiny amount of gain, just a very small amount of gain. There's a few things that all caregivers should do now that we live in a video game world. Number one is know the ratings and know the games. So you wouldn't talk about that soccer thing and never go to a soccer game and never watch your child play soccer. And yet, when kids go to play video games, they go to their room, they put on the headset, parents don't even know what the game is at all, they don't even know anything about it. And so when they try and talk to their kids about games, they sound like aliens. Tell me about that Minecraft that you're playing. Like, it just sounds so artificial. You don't talk that, we don't talk that way to our kids about soccer. We don't talk to our kids that way about, school, because we're intimately involved in those things. And if you don't, if you're not the type of caregiver that starts understanding the environment of the youth you're working with, you'll come off as sounding very alien. Knowing what the ratings mean is very important. There's almost all the games you buy are very strictly controlled, who can buy them. It's very hard for a 13-year-old to buy Grand Theft Auto 5. And Grand Theft Auto 5 is vilified in the media, and there's reasons for that. In Grand Theft Auto 5, you can hire a prostitute and murder them and steal the money. Probably not the most appropriate thing for a 10-year-old to be doing. But Grand Theft Auto 5 also includes, you can run a business. You can spend all your time in Grand Theft Auto 5 running a shipping industry. You don't have to be doing the negative things. So just like a movie or a TV show that has adult content, if parents understand what's inside that content, they can help put it into context. Who here is a parent who's watched an R-rated movie with their child? A movie with violence, or a movie with some sort of questionable content? You have? And it provokes discussion. Sometimes it's uncomfortable, sometimes it's not, but it's art and it provokes discussion. That's sort of the point of it. You always want to encourage a varied experience. You don't want to take a child going from video game playing to no video gaming. You want them to enjoy the world, enjoy everything that's around. Youth should be a time of building skills. Youth should be like the stem cells of the universe. They could do anything and be anything. And if all they're doing is shaping towards video games, they're missing out on some things that might be very enjoyable, they might have a lot of skill in, they might truly do well in. And so you want to encourage varied experience. So the target should be less about minimizing game use and maximizing variety of experiences. So it's really important to me that you get some physical activity. It's really important to me that you have some real world social relationships. It's very important to me that you enjoy your gaming. It's very important to me that you get your sleep, that you go to your school. All of those things have to exist together. It can't be just one or the other. I'd encourage most parents to play alongside their child, especially early on. It's so common for me to be in a restaurant or something and see the kid just handed the iPad. Here's your iPad, play it. And that's replicated at home, sit in front. And media is something that needs to be co-consumed. You need to know what's going on, and it's important to do. And the last thing is, remember at the beginning I said that games should be recreational? Everything we do recreationally should be after we've achieved our real-world responsibilities. If I skipped on today's presentation and went home and played some NBA 2K17, which I really want to do, if I did that, I'd be shirking my real-world responsibilities. And there would be consequences. I'd get an angry phone call. Hey, where are you? What's going on? What's happened? We wanted you to be here and you didn't show up. I might not ever be asked to give another talk again. There would be some real-world responsibilities that I have to meet. But at the end of the day today, actually I have a dinner at 6. At the end of my dinner at 6, I'm going home and I'm playing NBA 2K17. Because I enjoy playing that game. It's something that I like to do. And so we're not in the habit of taking away someone's recreation. We just really want to establish what recreation means. Recreation is something you do for fun when you've done the things you need to do, right? It's not the thing you do to waste time. It's not the thing you do to fall asleep. It's not the thing you do when you can't go to school. It's the thing you do when you've done all the other things that you need to do. Okay? And so that's the type of language that's realistic that will help prepare children. Giving them the language that video games are bad for you, or you have to get off these video games have ruined you, is really the type of gaming negative talk that makes children's brains just click right off. They just go, forget it, I'm done, this conversation is over, I'm not listening to you. But if you're talking about how successful you want someone to be, and how much you recognize that games are fun, but there's a time and a place for that, and let's try and figure out a way to do these other things that need to get done, then you're having a child that will at least understand that at the end of the day, you still support their ability to play games, whether or not you agree on how much they should play. So, I come from a very sort of gaming positive side. I've certainly seen negative outcomes of gaming. I've seen tons of people who game way too much. I just don't treat them any different than I would someone who has too much of anything else, whatever that thing is. I don't focus too much on the fact that it's video games. Video games come across as foreign, but they all come down to some very basic mechanics. They're all hand-eye coordination stuff or problem solving or puzzle solving or twitchy stuff. It's all some really basic things. And so if you understand video games, if you understand the video game world, you'll be able to communicate that language really well. So I thought I was going to be able to plug in to show some pictures of some differences. One of the things that I would really encourage all parents and caregivers to do is around age 12, start seeing themselves as providers, rather as guides and providers rather than caregivers. Because at age 12, is you start seeing the separation where children start resisting caregiving. But they do need guides, and they do need providers. They do need people to say, here's how you get this done, or here's what I think is important. They don't need, here, let me wipe that for you. Okay? They don't need, turn off the game right now. They need a much more elevated discussion about those things. And so I really encourage people who are working with parents to start fostering that parent as a provider and guide role, rather than a provider and caretaker role. At around adolescence. And that's where I see most of the discrepancies in video game use. So, sorry, it was a visual presentation. I tried to describe it as I was going. I think I'm okay on time, or is that?
Yeah, we do have a second speaker that will be speaking, so that's
sure.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Black, and maybe we can get that visual presentation to put up on our website. It's at the end, but first I'm excited to introduce our second speaker, Hantao Yuan. Hantao?
Hello.
Hello, we can hear you.
I'll just start with a little bit of self-history, I guess. So I started gaming when I was in high school, in I'd say about grade 11, and that's when I started playing about 6 to 8 hours a day, and I used it as a sort of escape in order to get rid of all the stress from high school, graduation soon, and then when I entered high school, university, I did similar things. And it was because I was in a new environment, trying to get used to it, and I couldn't really fit in until I started making more friends. And these friends that I made were actually in the esports club that I joined when I was in my first year. And when I entered into UBC, I just wanted to get volunteer hours, right? My parents back then, they wanted me to go to med school, be a lawyer, be an engineer, right? A stable job that parents would consider. And I wanted some volunteering experience to develop my leadership skills and my resume. So I just decided to join the esports club because that was one of my interests and my hobbies that I spent time on. And when I joined this club, I would say that my life changed for the better because instead of viewing gaming as a negative stigma, what we try to do within the club is try to use gaming as a platform to develop real life skills. A lot of the skills that you use in gaming, for example, communication, resource management, marketing, etc., can be applied to real life scenarios. And right now, the industry of esports is so expansive. There's experts coming in from TV companies who do marketing for them, who moved to a company here in Vancouver to do marketing for them at this dev. And a lot of the skills that are learned through video games can be applied to real life. And at UBC Esports, we try to use that as a positive reinforcement for people to develop their leadership skills, their teamwork skills, their communication skills. And we don't want to view gaming as a negative perspective. And a lot of market research right now has shown that esports is, and gaming is, the new industry. For example, ESPN, a popular and official news reporting site for sports, they started an esports division. And they just released news that recently the Philadelphia 76ers have actually bought a professional team. And other companies, like Shaq O'Neal and Rick Fox, and a lot of NBA teams in North America have started investing into esports because they can see the tangibility of this industry and how gaming can relate and reach all of the millennials that are growing up. I have a 7-year-old brother who's an expert at Plants vs. Zombies and Minecraft. He uses those as a way to spend time with my dad because my dad plays with him and my brother really enjoys that time. And I think that if parents started supporting children and helping them learn that the skills that they're learning inside of playing video games is really useful for real world applications, then I think instead of just for the kids to use it as an escape and a way to de-stress, that parents can really make an impact for them growing up with video games. And right now, after graduation and spending 3 years as a board member on the club, I'm currently working to do business development and marketing for a company called WongYu. And what we're doing right now, some of the projects, one, we're opening up a gaming space on campus for all of the students to use. And that way, if between classes, they have some free time that they can drop in and either do some homework or they can play some video games as a way to de-stress from their lectures and all the homework that they have. And another project we're working on is a scholarship program with international students. And what we wanted to do with that is we want to bring in students from all over the world to come to learn at UBC, but not just learn anything, but to specifically learn about skills required to enter the esports industry. Skills like marketing, business development, project management, teamwork, communication, all those other skills that I mentioned before. But they're going to be applicable to esports as they are to any other job that's common within any industry right now. And apparently, the person I mentioned who came from a TV company, he said this to me. He said that I foresee in the next 10 years that television is going to start dying. And the new thing will be online streaming and esports, video gaming. And another representative at a streaming site called Twitch, which is similar to YouTube or Netflix, they have more concurrent viewers throughout the year, daily, than any event shown on television other than the Super Bowl. So that means they have more live viewers watching online than any other event throughout the year, FIFA, baseball, soccer, and all those other real sports, except for the Super Bowl. At UBC Esports, we believe gaming has a positive reinforcement to learn other skills, and that's a major goal that we strive towards. Also, another project we're currently working on is actually a high school program. And what we're doing with that program is we're helping mentor the high schoolers so that they can develop leadership skills, learn how to write a resume, how to write a cover letter, how to do proposals so they can ask for resources for their events, but also as well as event management so they learn how to interact with these people and how to run events. And we want to start teaching them early because a lot of high schools right now, it's unstructured, and utilizing our brand, we can really help them grow their own brands as well as their own clubs within high schools so that way teachers don't just think that, oh, video gaming is a waste of their time, they're not studying math, sciences, etc. But here I am. I graduated with in honors in chemistry, but I still love to do this on the side. And I got a job right out of graduation. And I really believe that if a child is passionate about playing video games, then a parent should support them and help them use that as a method to develop other skills.
Thank you. That was really great. And so that was the end of our speakers, since one of our speakers couldn't join us today. But it was great to have Dr. Black and also have Han Tao speak to their perspectives on video games. So now is the time, we have a little bit of time to take some questions. And so the first group of people that I'd go to is telehealth. So if any of the telehealth sites have any questions for either of our speakers, now is your chance to speak up. Any questions from Sam and Arm?
Hi, yeah, we're having a discussion here just about small children. We got the feeling that Dr. Black was sort of talking about, 10, 11 and up. What about small children and video gaming? What do you think would be some appropriate limits to start with and set and go from there? Thank you.
Yeah, it's a really good question. Some of the guidelines that exist, like the pediatric guidelines, will say like no more than 3 hours of screen time for young children. So in a day, if I look at my day, I literally have a screen pointing at me right now, or I'm looking at my phone. My watch has a screen on it. These guidelines tend to be pretty archaic, and it's difficult. It's really difficult to know. Really young children play lots of video games. So some of the surveys that I've seen showing like three-year-olds, like 80%, 83%, 85% play video games, all the way up to, adolescence, where it's like in the very high 90s. So certainly it's happening. The I tend to shy away from strong limits on anything, because a numerical limit doesn't really speak to quality. Like if there's a child who's, for example, struggling with autism and they're really good at Minecraft and it's one of the things they enjoy to do and they're spending 6 hours a day building things in Minecraft, you know, is that necessarily bad or good? It's very hard to say based off of the number of hours. It's a question of whether or not it's productive, whether or not there's learning going on, whether or not it's a safe behavior. Children who, I myself get very personally turned off anytime I see devices being used as babysitters. But at the same time, when I see the child, I'm very glad when I'm a patron in a restaurant and the device is pulled out as a babysitter. So there's a practical use to giving a child something to do to occupy their time. So, you know, it's difficult to come up with anything hard and firm. I hope one of the themes that came out of my talk is that the game itself is less concerning to me than the variety of activities that a child has. Because children really are pluripotent. They can do lots of different things. We actually don't know their skill set till they're well into their teens. They might be awesome latent singers and they just tried singing once when they're 13 and we find out. So it really should be a goal of childhood should be a broad experience of many different things and a safe experience where they're allowed to explore things in a safe environment rather than specific hours of doing something. So it's difficult for me to comment on it specifically. I think some people get really rigid around rules in the same way that bedtimes become very rigid. Like, you know, a child's arguing to stay up an extra 15 minutes and sometimes the argument takes an hour and a half over 15 minutes and the argument gives you an hour and a half less of sleep than giving them the 15 minutes would have. Sometimes I see some of those arguments getting down to too structured. But if you're generally giving a child a good broad experience, you're probably helping them. Sorry if it's not very prescriptive. I wish I could say X number of hours. It would be pretty awesome.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, we have a message here with our young parents that we discourage any screen time at all till they're two. That it should be more sort of physical interaction and that sort of a thing, and then very limited after that. And when they do have screen time, it's sort of with the parents and interactive till they go to school. Mm-hmm. So you know, because screen time, let's face it, there's screens everywhere, right?
Yeah.
And you know, your phone, your iPad, your TV. So, anyways, it's interesting to consider, and maybe the research is changing out there then. What we sort of are basing some of our messages on, I don't know.
I think it's not a bad message before two. I mean, developmentally, there's a lot of like basic things like how much can a child see until age two. I do really think one of the messages that needs to be hammered home very early in the game experience for children is that parents are a part of the gaming world in the same way that parents attend all of the soccer games and parents attend all of the, you know, all of the performances and the plays and stuff like that. They need to be a part of the gaming world. It doesn't mean they sit down beside and play every game with their kid, but they have to understand it and they have to sit with them, for sure.
Thank you. Victoria, do you have a question? No? Okay, great, thank you. I think next we'll go to the phone. So if there's anyone on the phone line that would like to ask either Dr. Black or Han Tao a question, now is your chance.
Hi, this is Katrina from Prince George, and I have a question. I work with youth forensics, so we have a lot of individuals who gaming is a huge issue. You mentioned a Dr. Krushdie.
Krushdini.
A little bit more idea of how to locate his material.
So the name is Krushdini, D-I-N-I. First name is Kourosh, K-O-U-R-O-S-H. My presentation that I was basing my talk off of, I've also emailed to Lindsay so that she can make it available. It has a picture of the book on it as well. It's a book that was written in about 2010 or 2009, and it's a pretty good summary of why children game and what they get out of it, and it provides a pretty balanced approach. The media, so just like laws or anything else, the media tends to lag behind the trend. So books today about gaming today are actually kind of out of date already by the time they're published. Kind of like trying to find science around this. So I think that's a book that I'd recommend. But you know, most of the strategies that we're relying on are general collaborative child strategies that have been around since Dr. Green's problem, the explosive child, or things like that. So they're going back, 10, 20 years before gaming was even a thing.
Yeah, we find with with forensics, we have many youth who are using the gaming world and trying to replicate it in their real world, and it's led to a lot of violence and stuff. Can you speak to that a bit?
The question about video games and violence is a topic all on its own. It would take a really long time to go through. So in general, the predictors of violence have very little to do with media exposure and very much to do with genetics, exposure to trauma and aggression at an early age, the safety of an environment that you grow up in, the availability of resources, social success, learning disorders, those types of things. The overall effect of playing video games on violent behavior is probably quite small. If we're looking effect size, I don't know if I speak to any of the sciences in the room, but generally when we look at effect size, we want something around 0.4 to 0.6 to be pretty significant effect. The effect of video games on violence is probably around 0.06, 0.1. It's a pretty small effect. And what we actually tended to see in the last 10 years is children have become far less violent, far less sexual, far less into drugs and alcohol. All of these things are at record lows. So in general, even though there's been a huge rise in the amount of gaming, there's overall been a general trend towards things that are a little bit more socially acceptable. So I would, in the forensic population, you're dealing with a very, very select group of people who have a number of disadvantages early on in life, and they may be more impressionable by video games, but I'm quite confident that if we remove video games from their life, they'd still have a number of risk factors for violence or problematic behavior. So I'm not sure to what degree video gaming plays. It's probably there and it's probably small, but family environment, exposure to trauma, history of aggression in the family, witnessed violence, those types of things, even the environment you grow up on, are probably much stronger effects on youth growing up.
Great, thank you. I think we'll move on to another speaker on the phone. If anyone else has any questions, go ahead.
I have a question, and I'm not sure who it's for, but is there any research to show that playing excessive games has an effect on the ability of the team to focus and to concentrate? I guess as a parent, I'm used to sitting here quietly, be able to focus and do my work. But my son is listening to music while he's studying. He's also gaming. He's on Facebook. He's just multitasking. But it's like the attention span is just not there. Am I wrong?
Well, I can say that, so I'll take the question. The rates of inattention in ADHD have not changed in about 25 years. So the same amount of kids who struggle with inattention and inattentive behaviors are there. But within the spectrum of normal attention span, that's clearly changing. YouTube videos are too long for most kids. They now need Vines to get their videos in less than 15 seconds. And even Snapchats are often less than 15 seconds. So I would say that normal attention span is certainly changing. It's kind of like when I was a child, my parents were always on my case for being on the phone too much, and now children today are being told to get off the internet. I think in the same way that what's changing for normal attention span is definitely changing societally, but problematic attention span, not so much. Like the true problem disorders like ADHD and inattention due to like biological things haven't changed. I think it's just children today have much more available media and information to them, and they can, if they need to know something, they don't call the librarian or go look it up. They ask Google and it tells them in 3 seconds. So there isn't a huge value to waiting or patience. Children haven't really learned the need for those things. So it certainly is socially changing. Whether or not it's a good thing, I'll leave for theologians and philosophers to debate. But I certainly do see that a lot, where the child is multitasking in a number of ways. And it's almost like, how can you pay attention in that environment? And I would struggle to do so. But I see these same kids with the music playing and the Netflix running and the gaming going, and they're still rocking A's in school, and I don't get how they do it. So it's difficult to know.
We have time for one more question on the phone before we go to the room for questions as well. So if there's anyone that's got a very urgent question, now is your last chance on the phone. Okay, so let's go to the room. Is there anyone in the room that'd like to ask a question of either of our speakers?
My question has to do with kids who are spending a lot of time on gaming and not very much time with other children and peers. And so they're not really having that face-to-face interaction, and I'm wondering about sort of loneliness and social skill development and some of those kinds of things.
Yeah. So any child who games too much is, like, games too much as defined in they should be doing other things but they're gaming instead, whether it's sleep or school or going out with friends, they're going to lose development compared to their peers. All children develop, they gain skills, it all goes up until about age 24, we flatten out and start losing skills. No, we gain different skills. But they all go up. Children who are really good gamers, their hand-eye coordination may continue to just rock, but then their academic achievements start falling off or their social development starts falling off. So any one area that becomes unbalanced is going to stunt the development and growth in those areas. It's really important to know if a child's gaming a lot, whether or not they're gaming online. Online communities can be robust communities. If you're playing an online role-playing game, you could have a guild of 24 people that you interact with regularly. They're all online, and we may not value those friendships as much as we value real-life friendships, but they do, for sure. They definitely feel these are their real friends. So it is important to know the type of gaming, but I would say any child who's gaming too much is probably missing out on opportunities to develop in other areas, whether it's physically, socially, academically, even just another skill set aside from the gaming skill set. So it is really about preaching balance that I find the most helpful. Did I answer your question? Or?
Yeah, it's just, I think sometimes the gaming is so attractive.
Yeah.
Right? And it's harder to go out and be with people, especially as, you know, you're 10 to 14, 10 to 15, when you're feeling more vulnerable socially, you feel safer. And how do you help?
And when you add, for example, an anxiety disorder, and it makes going to school really hard, the gaming becomes even more attractive because anxiety doesn't need to overcome using the video game. So it's probably less about the video game itself and more about why is it hard? Like, why are those other things hard? Some kids, you can't keep them away from school. They're like, oh, it's school, get away. I always like September because you get all these Facebook pictures of people like shooing their parents away as they're taking the final picture. But there are kids who gaming is a more attractive solution than tackling any of their problems. And it's not to discount the realness of that difficulty, but I would like to downplay a little bit that it's about the video game, and it may be more about the challenges that it's offered. I would say teachers have a long way to go to incorporating video games into their schoolwork. There is no reason I can discern that kids should not be playing more games at school. I cannot figure out why teachers as a group are so entrenched, especially union, specifically professional teachers unions, are so entrenched against using video games at school. They are absolutely against it. And I don't understand it because they attract kids' attention, they definitely teach skills, all kids want to do them. We don't want kids to be playing like Grand Theft Auto at school, but if you could gamify things more, look at the success of geocaching in Pokemon Go and getting kids to go out and walk around. It's amazingly successful by using their attention. So I do think schools have a long way to go to integrating why we know these things are so attractive to kids into school work. School work right now tends to be a lot of sit down and read, which just does not play to everybody's skills. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I think I saw another question.
Yeah, I was wondering how you counsel parents. In that you say specifically, like, you don't want to focus on, like, don't do the video games, but you have to, it is considered like recreational, so you have to do your real world, like, world activities first, and then you can have this as kind of like a,
yeah,
when you're finished, kind of a reward. So how do you counsel kids who want to do this, but they have real world responsibilities to do first? You say,
right,
do you use, like, the reward system? Is that what you recommend? Or how do you
encourage? So younger kids do better with behavioral things.
Right.
So younger kids struggle with cognition. So they do struggle with, you know, thinking and planning and organizing. So you may want to use a little bit more behavioral strategies on younger children, rewarding good behavior, not rewarding bad behavior, different than punishing bad behavior. With children who are starting to hit puberty, so around adolescence, you really do start have to say to the child, these are my goals, what are your goals, and how can we make our goals match up? So it's important. So I don't care that you're playing video games right now, but I do care that you go to school. So you have to come up with me with a solution that allows you to play the games you want to play, me to make sure that you're going to school so I can be a good parent, and both of us can meet our needs. If the child is involved in the development of their own strategy, they also have to be involved in the fixing of that strategy. If you're someone who's trying to tell a child to do something and it doesn't work, then you have all the work of trying to figure out what to do next. And you're setting yourself up for some really hard conversations. You have to turn the game off at 10, and then they don't turn off at 10. Well, now you have to turn off at 11. You're out of solutions. But if the child says, look, I think after 10 I don't need to play games anymore, I'll turn this off and I'll go to school and blah, 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 and the next day they didn't do that, the conversation you can have with the child the next morning is, hey, you said 10, what happened? What are we going to do about that? And you're becoming a little bit more collaborative in how that problem becomes solved. And it sounds a little bit like it's not give them what they want. It's make sure they recognize that when they're out there in the real world, they have to solve their own problems. They have to develop their own solutions, and they have to work for them. So it's less my job to tell you what to do, and my job more to help you with some structure. So have some firm rules that don't change. Like bedtime cannot be later than X, but everything else is a negotiation. Everything else. As long as you meet your goals and I meet my goals, we're happy. And that's where I find the most success. So Ross Green's collaborative problem solving technique is like my bread and butter. If anyone here hasn't read The Explosive Child by Ross Green, even though it's describing a very specific younger child with explosive anxiety and stuff like that, the strategy inside the book is just phenomenal for dealing with all adolescents. So, yeah.
Thank you. We have time for maybe one or two more questions. I saw you took your hand up.
Yeah. My son has very significant mental health challenges that we dealt with at a very young age. He's 20 now. And gaming was a real struggle for us many points throughout his adolescence. We tried right from, like, we're going to lay down hard rules and turn off the internet and, you know, blow ups and all that kind of stuff, to starting to develop more relationships, get him to teach me about the game, spend time. My question is, when he got to be, like, grade 12, he started really getting into the gaming and he was slipping on what he was supposed to be doing. And at that point, Ross Green is fabulous. Huge, huge believer in that. So we did some of the collaborative, but I also set out, you know, if you can't manage this, then I'll have to help you manage it by, like, maybe looking into an Internet 10 package so that his game would turn into a slideshow.
Yeah.
When they can do the collaboration, but they can't follow through,
yeah,
they really want to, but they still can't, is it okay to lay a hard line like that?
That's where your adult brain has a huge advantage over someone even up to the age of 24.
Mm-hmm.
Their frontal lobe, which is really important for problem solving and planning and execution, is not fully cooked.
Yeah.
It doesn't really get developed till age 24. So prior to that, if you're providing structure to the thing they want to do,
mm-hmm,
then you're really benefiting someone. If you're applying both the structure and you're also applying what they want to do, it's never going to work. So the child's motivation needs to be there. Otherwise, the only thing a behavioral strategy will do will punish them. Mm-hmm. So they need some sort of motivational hook. They need to be bought into it in some way. Mm-hmm. And that's why I like the collaborative problem solving, is because it really does encourage the person to say, this is what I want, and then allows you to sort of tailor it.
Yeah.
Like, I would say, like, would there be a way to, you know, if I was looking at it, like, it looks to me like you're gaming too much and you're not meeting your needs. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's reasonable for me to slow down the internet here so that it's harder for you to game? Like, what do you think we should be doing here?
Yeah.
And if he's like...
Yeah, that was kind of the approach.
Yeah, maybe that's the best thing to do.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, absolutely. Because if he's providing the motivation and you're providing the backbone for that, mm-hmm. that's a successful strategy. Mm-hmm. You can't provide motivation for someone. So whether it's in addictions or in problem video game playing or even in going to see a therapist, I see lots of people are like, my son or my daughter isn't seeing anybody. Well, do they want to see somebody? The answer is no. There's no reason to go see someone. So they can't provide the motivation. They have to have some internal motivation, and at that point, you can provide the structure.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a good strategy.
Great. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for joining us today. I'd like to thank our speakers again, Dr. Black and Han Tao, for sharing your thoughts and insights on our topic today. And I also wanted to thank all of our attendees on telehealth and in person and on the phone. It's always great to have you. And I hope you enjoyed today. And a recording of the pinwheel will be available on our website in the next week or so once I get that edited and uploaded there. And I hope you'll join us for our next pinwheel. Our next pinwheel is going to be on Tuesday, November 22nd, and it will be on supporting a friend or loved one with an eating disorder. So enjoy the rest of your afternoon. Thank you. Bye.